Studies and Marine Corps University presents Drawing the Dagger, Local Insurrection and Global Insurgency in Contemporary Yemen by Dr. Christopher Swift, University of Virginia School of Law. This is the fifth lecture in a series being hosted by MES at MCU entitled Orienting Our Sights on the Future, the Opportunities and Challenges of the Arab Revolts. Christopher Swift is a fellow at the University of Virginia Law School's Center for National Security Law, where he specializes in international law, constitutional law, and contemporary armed conflict. An attorney and political scientist, Dr. Swift has conducted fieldwork in Afghanistan, the Middle East, and the former Soviet Union, examining Al-Qaeda's relationship with indigenous Muslim insurgencies. Dr. Swift previously served in the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, where he investigated transactions involving terrorist syndicates, weapons proliferators, and other sanctioned entities. He also served as an international law fellow at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, where he advised policymakers on sectarian violence in Iraq. Dr. Swift is a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a member of the American Society of International Law, and is admitted to the bar in New York and the District of Columbia. He holds an AB in Government and History from Dartmouth College, an MSD in International Relations from the University of Cambridge, a JD from Georgetown University, and a PhD in Politics and International Studies from the University of Cambridge. Dr. Swift is the author of the forthcoming book, The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies and Global Jihad. This lecture took place Tuesday, 7 February 2012, Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
Good morning, sir. Dr. Morris, greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here with us on the fifth Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University lecture series for the academic year 2011-2012, entitled Orienting Our Sights on the Future, the Opportunities and Challenges of the Arab Revolts. If you were here last month, we hosted Dr. Soner Chaabtai from the Washington Institute for Near East Studies to discuss Turkey, Turkey's role in the Arab Spring. That lecture's synopsis, written by Dr. Chaabtai, is available right here, which is our the third volume, first issue of our Middle East Insights. There are copies right to the right. If you need more of these copies or you want enough on our list, please see Adam Seitz to the left, left of me, right of you, and he will put you on that. This is Dr. Chaabtai's assessment. It's not exactly what he said here. It's more about Washington and Ankara's cooperation. And you may see that cooperation much more if things in Syria go a different way. I will not be announcing next month's talk because we are still trying to plan it. You will hear about it. It may not be here actually, it may be on base but different place. The topics, the last two topics, which will be March and April, will be Bahrain and Egypt. We don't know whether Bahrain will come or Egypt will come, but those are the two countries. Bahrain and Egypt, and one of them will be not here, but you will, those of you on our mailing list, you will get the details. If you're not and you want to get those details, again, please see Adam Seitz, you will be on that. Today we are going to hear about one of the most dangerous countries in the world, and most likely the most dangerous country in the Middle East. At least that's the assessment of most intelligence people in the intelligence community and outside of it. On 24 January, Yemen's President Ali Abdullah Saleh stepped down after 33 years of rule, and he is actually here in Washington somewhere, but to seek medical attention. But he has left behind a country in deep political turmoil and deep economic turmoil, and most of this, there are places in this country that are actually not ruled by the Yemenis, and the most dangerous aspect of it is that there are both Al-Qaeda, the traditional Al-Qaeda we understand, but also local Islamists and opportunists who are vying for power, for chunks of it. There's also, of course, the Iranian issue, how real, how not. makes Yemen a country that is very volatile, strategically very important where it sits. However, looking both from our side, the Western side, also from the countries in the region, specifically the Saudis, who happen to be right next to Yemen, there seems not to be a, at least on paper, a specific policy what to do with it. So I don't have an answer, but we have invited someone. Hopefully, will give us some answer about what is going on with Yemen. We are very fortunate to have Dr. Christopher Swift as our guest. Dr. Swift is a fellow at the University of Virginia Law School, Center for National Security Law. And I know Dr. Morris is wearing a University of Virginia tie. Thank you for wearing that, sir. Dr. Swift has conducted fieldwork in the Middle East, Afghanistan, and the former Soviet Union, examining Al-Qaeda's relationship with indigenous Muslim insurgencies. And the rest of his accomplishments you can read in the announcement in front of you. Dr. Swift holds a, he wears two hats. There are very few of those. He has a JD from Georgetown University and a PhD in politics and international studies from the University of Cambridge. So from the academia, he comes from a very, very high pedigree from both ends of it. And now he works with the University of Virginia, which is also, for those of us living in the Old Dominion, is a good pedigree. And please look for his upcoming book. It's called The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies and the Global Jihad. With that, Dr. Swift, thank you very much for the award.
My mic on. It is. Dr. Karzi, General Murray, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about a complicated place. Mean said that, mentioned that hopefully I would have some answers, I think, by the end of today's lecture. You will see that even those of us who've been following what's happening on the ground in Yemen have more questions than answers, and that these questions are unlikely to be resolved any time in the near future. As I was driving down from Washington, D.C. this morning, I was thinking over and over again about two Marines, the first being my grandfather, who was in the 5th Marine Division, fought Iwo Jima during the Second World War, and the second being my assistant scoutmaster back home in New Hampshire. Both of these gentlemen imparted a very important lesson to me, and I can explain that lesson briefly, and then thank you for the opportunity to give some of my knowledge back to the Marine Corps. The first was a love of country and a love of history. A love of country and history inspired by opening up the old Life magazines and looking at the pictures of the Higgins boats and having my grandfather talk about the various people that he knew in those pictures. He was a radio man. We all know how complicated life was at Iwo Jima for radio men. For Dave Laverne, my assistant scoutmaster, is a chap that fought very, very hard with Marine Recon in Vietnam and then went into the intelligence business for a very long time. Spent a lot of time undercover in Eastern Europe running all kinds of resources to some of the democracy movements that helped get things sorted out after the Iron Curtain came down. And then retired to New Hampshire to teach young men how to climb and handle themselves in the mountains. So the first gave me a love of country and a love of history, and the second gave me an appreciation for being able to apply your knowledge to discrete problems in the field. And one of the difficulties we've had in Washington, or I should say in the entire national security establishment over the space of the last decade, is the presumption that our knowledge does not need to be grounded in what's happening in the field. It can be derived from theory, or it can be derived from a historical analogy, or it can be derived from our particular perception about a particular group of people that may or may not be very well tested. And let's be very clear, there are some very nasty people in this world, but not every nasty group agrees with each other. And not all of the dynamics that we've tended to aggregate over the space of the last decade are necessarily comparable. There may be a lot of superficial similarities, but the local and global factors that factor into these relationships are something that's sort of been lost in all of that. So what I'm going to try to do today is start off with a global perspective, bring it down to a regional perspective, and then get really down to the nitty-gritty of what's happening in Yemen and give you sort of, as best I can tell, the ground truth. And I'm going to take that ground truth and we're going to bring it back up to our global, our regional priorities and our strategic priorities. So if you'll forgive me, we'll do a zoom in and a zoom out, so to say. Let's see here. What do I have to press? So a brief lecture outline. First, I'm going to go through three levels of analysis, global, regional, and local. Second, I'm going to give you some background, right? The situation report from Yemen today. What does the situation look like for society, for the economy, for the ecology, and for the political situation? Then we're going to look at the local insurrections in Yemen. There are three sources of instability. Only one of them is al-Qaeda, and I really want to drill down on the non-al-Qaeda threats currently in Yemen. Then we'll look at the al-Qaeda threat. We'll look at the return of al-Qaeda from the Afghan theater back into Arabia and their attempts to set up shop there. Then we'll do a net assessment of the current situation, again, looking at these three levels of analysis. We'll look at the policy implications. And then I'll conclude with a metaphor regarding the title, drawing the dagger. Right, what does it mean to draw the dagger? Well, it means different things depending on your level of analysis. And it also means different things depending on how granular your analysis is, how close you can get down to not just the culture, not just the country, but the actual people. Because in this domain, like in most things in international relationship, people are the ones making the decisions. Right? It's not about systems, it's not about machines, it's not about technology. It's about agency. It's about individual people. And we lose that a lot in some of the analysis that we do on the region. So, first, levels of analysis, first starting with global trends. Major global trends. These are the major metatrends in three domains. First, demographic. Across the world, but especially in the Middle East, we are seeing growing populations, extremely high youth populations, right? Historically very destabilizing. Rapid urbanization, especially in developing countries, but also in sort of semi-developed countries like the Middle East. We're also seeing the proliferation of the media, right? Look at the Arab Spring. Explain to me how the Arab Spring happens without email, without the internet, without Twitter, without Facebook, without all of these tools that these urbanized, youthful, and increasingly well-educated populations use to communicate with one another. Metatrend number one. Global trend number two, economic. We all know what this means. Economic stagnation, high unemployment, resource constraints, major resource constraints in various parts of the world, especially the Middle East, especially water, and rising commodity prices. Right? What is the number one thing that got the Tunisian revolt started in the Arab Spring? It wasn't just pride. Right? It was also the price of food, the price of vegetables, the price of ordinary staples. If you want to know whether the Indian government is going to flip over, you can track it based on the price of food. You know, it correlates very nicely with the price of others. As food prices change, people start to change their behavior towards their economy and the government because it's very lucrative for them. The third global trend is a political trend. And I'm going to draw on an observation made by my mentors, Vivian Brzezinski, as some of the old equilibriums that we've built up over the 20th century start to collapse. Some of these things wither away or lose their legitimacy. The politics of populism, again, fed by new media, urbanization, higher levels of education, is starting to change and in some cases replacing the traditional politics of power, politics of institutions, of states, of regimes, the politics that we generally consider international relations. This is a blending, right, of the personal, the social, and the political in a way that they didn't really see very much of in the latter half of the 20th century. So what does this mean for the Middle East? Well, let's take a look at some of the regional dynamics. Nationalism. There has been a progressive rejection over the space of the last 15 years of secular nationalist regimes across the Middle East and a rise of populist movements, be they democratic or Islamist. And interestingly, some of the Islamist movements are democratic, but not in the way that we would consider them to be. The second major trend is the rise of sectarianism, right? As the notion of secular nationalism starts to fade away, we're seeing increasing Shia Sunni tensions across the region, from Bahrain to Iraq, to Pakistan, to Saudi Arabia, their eastern provinces, Syria, very obviously right now, and yes, indeed in Yemen, although not in the same fashion as in other places. And then finally, we have this major change in the structure and focus of al-Qaeda itself, the structure and focus of the jihadi Salafi movement generally. And that is a migration or recolonization. For the last 10 years, al-Qaeda has been out on the periphery, the cultural periphery, the linguistic periphery, the theological periphery of Islam. They've been in places like Bosnia, they've been in places like the North Caucasus, they've been in places like Central Asia and Afghanistan. This is not core Islam. Right? There are Arabs and there are strangers in a strange land in many of these instances. Well, that's changing, and in Yemen it's changing very, very quickly. This migration back from the periphery to the core is something that's happening not only in terms of our security concerns, but also in terms of how al-Qaeda conceives of itself and conceives of its revolutionary objectives. So we'll get into that. And then local challenges, Yemen-specific challenges. Well, in Yemen, we have three of them. The first is the Northern Rebellion. We have Shia rebels, the Houthi rebels, who are locked in a perpetual struggle against the Sunni-led regime. It's a majority Sunni-led regime. Well, there are some Shia in it. We have a Southern Secessionist movement, right, based on the old People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. Remember, if you'd asked this question 30 years ago, and you said, well, someone's giving a lecture on Yemen, you'd say, which one? North Yemen or South Yemen? Well, now there's one Yemen, but those old tensions and those old lines have not necessarily faded away. In fact, they've been perpetuated into contemporary Yemen politics. And the third is this Eastern insurgency. It's the return of al-Qaeda, the recolonization of its own society by forging tribal alliances and taking territory, literally taking territory, something al-Qaeda has never really been able to do very well in any one of up to five provinces in Eastern and Southern Yemen. So, Yemen itself, a bit of background, looking at the population, the economy, and very importantly in the case of Yemen, the ecology. And I'll explain why that's the case as we move first. First, population. Core statistics on the Yemeni population. GDP per capita is $2,700. What was your last mortgage payment? 34% of the Yemeni population is unemployed. No employment. Not partially employed, not a little bit of nights and weekends, no. Unemployed, not functioning in the society. 45% of Yemenis live below the United Nations poverty line. The United Nations poverty line is substantially below the U.S. poverty line. So think of the poorest people you know in the United States and push that as far down as you possibly can. Nearly half the population is there. 50% of the population in Yemen is illiterate, right? Not capable of engaging with the modern world through the written word. 60% of the population, remember, high youth population, 60% of the population in Yemen is below age 25. 73% of the population is rural. This is a very important point. When journalists and scholars and lawyers and human rights activists and all the rest go to Yemen, the Yemenis that they're meeting are not these Yemenis who are in these categories, right? They're in the 27% of urban Yemenis who are literate, right, who probably are employed and certainly aren't dealing with this kind of GDP per capita, right? So our perspective on what's happening in Yemen is shaped by who we talk to there. That's something we need to keep in mind as we move along. 73% of the rural, 9.9 million small arms. That's a conservative estimate. 9.9 million small arms in a country of 24 million people. Remember that 50% of the population is going to be elderly, and about 50% of the population is going to be female. Remember, 60% of the population is below 25. In terms of an armed society, you have to come to the United States or Finland before you come to a society that's nearly as armed as Yemen. Most importantly, it's 20% the size of Saudi Arabia. And a lot of people in a very small space, right next to Saudi Arabia, which has about the same number of people and a whole lot of this. Let's look at the economic situation. Again, negative trends. Our trends here in the West are pretty bad. Their trends there are pretty devastating. Currently spending about 6.6% of GDP on the national security establishment, including the military, the intelligence, the police, all the rest. We're spending what? Less than 5, somewhere around 4 here in the United States? Just to give you a sense of how much of their economy is dedicated to that function, the internal security function. Right? They have an 11% annual inflation rate. Now, the last time we saw 11% inflation was in the 1970s, anything near 11% was in the 1970s, and imagine how devastating that was for our economy. 36% public debt as a share of GDP, right? More than a third of what they make every year is going to pay debt. Imagine your family budget. If a third of what you pay every month is credit card payments, you're never going to get out of that trap. 50% reduction in the last 3.5 years, 50% reduction in oil and gas production. Oil and gas production, right? Their reserves are almost completely dry. But 70% of government revenue, right, with these population statistics, with these economic statistics, 70% of government revenue is derived from the oil and gas sector. And their entire political system that President Saleh built, some people call it Dancing on the Heads of Snakes, that's the name of the book that's currently out there, is based on patronage to tribes and managing the rents among taking the resources and spreading the wealth of those resources, that derive from those resources around certain segments of the population and where they came from first quarter. So basically, even if you could get the economy to function, even if you could bring all this other stuff, the way you set things up on the governmental level, the relationship between the private sector and the economy and the political system, is such that they're in a state of collapse. Right? And they're going to be heading in a state of collapse regardless of the insurgencies and insurrections that they need to deal with. Let's take it to the next level, the ecology. Looming ecological collapse. 2.9% arable land. Right? You can only farm 3% of the land in Yemen. The rest is deserts and mountains. You can't farm it. 220 cubic meters of water available per capita on an annual basis. By comparison, Saudi Arabia is somewhere around 750 to 800. The United States is somewhere around 3,000 to 3,500. Depending on what part of the country you live in. You have to go to a volcanic guano island in the South Pacific to find a place that has less water available for the population. Right? There are a few other places where the water drawdown is higher than it is in Yemen, but if you look at their actual reserves, and you compare the reserves to the population carrying capacity, it is catastrophic. In fact, it is so bad that they're projecting either this year or next year an imminent failure of urban water supply. Now, that's the Germans projecting it. They could be wrong, they could be right. They revise the number every year, but still the situation is quite dire. Notably, 60% of the fresh water, 60% of the potable water that they do have is being used to cultivate cotton. Right? It's a narcotic plant that young men chew and use to knock themselves out so they can forget all the other statistics we've been talking about. They also have one of the highest growth rates in the world, population growth rates in the world. Right? In 1975, Yemen was less than 10 million. They're now at 24 million. In the next 15 to 20 years, the population is set to double to more than 40 million. Right? They are growing out of control at the same time that their economy is collapsing, their political equilibrium is falling apart, their institutions are incapable of delivering, and they're running out of water. So that's the background. So let's take a look at the local insurrections, right? The people in Yemen who have picked up guns and are trying to, or using politics, or using whatever instruments are available to them to change the political situation, to reform or recharacterize the state. First, a little bit of history. North and South, this is not the TV miniseries about the Civil War. But in 1990, there was a merger between the two Yemens, the Republic of Yemen in the North, and the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen in the South. For those of you who don't remember the Soviet Union, anytime you see the words People's Democratic Republic, that's a communist regime, or at least a Soviet-aligned socialist regime. In 1993-1994, that merger goes terribly wrong. The prime minister goes back to Aden's, and they start shooting missiles at one another. War lasts about 16 months, if I remember it correctly, and the North eventually wins. But in the process of winning, the North, right, the Arab nationalists in the North, the secular Arab nationalists under Saleh versus the former socialists, former Moscow-aligned socialists in the South, in the process of winning that war, the North reaches out to these Afghan Arabs that are coming back from Afghanistan. Don't forget that Yemen had a lot of volunteers that went to fight Jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan. So he reaches out to these groups and tries to pull them into his, mobilize them and use Islam to mobilize this struggle against, the godless communists of the South. Right? He's trying to capture that whole notion that was very popular at the time, the legacy of the Soviet ethic. Well, the South is eventually repressed and defeated, but the resentment goes on, right? And the resentment, the receptacle for that resentment today in Yemeni politics is the Yemeni Socialist Party. They are one of the largest parties in Yemen. And if you see anybody running an operation in the street, right, you see a street protest, that's probably in line somewhere with the YSP. If you see anybody wearing pink banners, right, that's a YSP-organized event. So consolidation of power, how does Saleh take this society that's been driven apart, just been through a civil war, and try to pull together a unitary state? Well, he does it by emulating Saddam Hussein, right? To the extent that people in the region were calling him the little Saddam in the early 1990s. He actually aligned with Saddam during the Gulf War. Bad move for him on the relations front. Probably a good move for him in terms of consolidating his credibility with other secular nationalist Arab regimes. Nonetheless, we see see what history would that one out. So he tries to create a secular Arab republic modeled on Egypt and Rome, right? There'll be a place for religion, but the state will control everything. There'll be a centralized state dominated by the General People's Congress Party, right? A national party, a secular party with him at the top. The southern adversaries, the former secessionists, the enemy socialists and others, are folded into the political system through parliament, right? But they're such a small minority that even if the parliamentary system functioned properly, they still wouldn't be able to exercise much of the way of power. They can do little more than advocate for rest, the same way tribal and other groups do. Islamists inside Yemeni society are also accommodated to a certain degree through the political system. But ultimately, in terms of the power structure, they're sidelined as well. Right? So everyone gets a bit, symbolically. But in terms of the power structure, much like Egypt, very similar to Egypt, little Saddam is in charge. What you have is this weird alignment, this fundamentally incongruous historical alignment with a highly centralized state. Right, a highly centralized state apparatus in what has traditionally been, since before Islam, going all the way back to the times of the Romans, when the Romans used to call Yemen Arabia Felix, happy Arabia, as opposed to Saudi Arabia, that was the unhappy Arabia. You have this fundamentally decentralized society. Decentralized in terms of religious authority, decentralized in terms of religious authority, political authority, decentralized in terms of the economy, in terms of everything. Everything's very personal, right? You're trying to impose, square peg in a round hole, essentially. But Saleh makes it work. He makes it work for almost four decades. How does he make it work? Through a system, a very sophisticated system of tribal patronage and rights. Extracting the resources, turning those resources into funds that can be used to buy the loyalty temporarily of one group after another group after another group. Incidentally, this is not a strategy that's native to the Middle East. Right? Vladimir Putin's regime in Russia does much the same thing. They do it on a much larger scale in a much more sophisticated manner. But the fundamental method of managing a large and complex society is basically the same. Right? It's a distribution of rents rather than creation of value. So, after 40 years, when those rents start to dry up, as the economy starts to collapse, as the water table drops, as the oil and gas reserves dwindle away, we start to see fragmentation. And the fragmentation first starts with the disloyal opposition, right? In a functioning democracy, you have everyone who's sort of bought into the institutions of the rule of law. And so you know that eventually your party could be in power, so you want to preserve those institutions so you can use them to promote your political agenda when you do, in fact, come to power. Well, because Yemen's never been a functioning democracy, the opposition, even though it's inculcated into some of the political institutions, remains fundamentally disloyal. They have no incentive to buy into the process. In fact, they have every incentive to use the process to maximize their efforts to extract more rents, whether they are the Yemeni Socialist Party or whether they are tribal groupings. So the disloyal opposition breaks up into, currently, is set up into three major groups. The first is the Al-Islah, the Islamist coalition. Now that Islamist coalition is about as fragmented as you could possibly imagine. Calling them a coalition is, I'll use a kind word, it's an exaggeration. Because within that coalition, you have the Islamists in the south that's beating each other up over whose interpretation of Islam's patristic period is the most authentic and most applicable to the present day. Then you have the Muslim Brotherhood, which most American analysts would put into the same category as the Islamists and Salafists. The Muslim Brotherhood actually isn't that concerned about the Quran and the patristic period. They're more concerned about modernity, right? How do we have a society that's both Islamic and modern? They used to be that in this category, but they've evolved a lot in the last 50 years. And you have tribal leaders who sort of bought into Al-Islah because it's conservative and it sort of resonates with their conservative era of tribal values. Then you have the leftists, right? You have the Yemeni Socialist Party. Remember pink banners? I think you'll see some pink in this picture. Yep, this guy's got a pink banner. This is a YSP rally or demonstration. And you have three smaller leftist parties. And by leftist, I mean, oh my God, is Marx still alive? This is where your university professors show up. These are the folks that your journalists usually run into when they're talking to Yemenis. And so not because these are the folks that speak English. When NBC Nightly News shows up in Yemen, we're going to talk to people who speak English. And then you have your opportunists. Every society has them. Yemen has no shortage of them. And those Yemen, and those opportunities include recently tribal actors who are shifting allegiances depending on what kind of benefits they see themselves getting. And remember that tribal leaders also have to distribute rents to their population. And we also have recently, in the space of the last year, army defectors, people who have left the national security establishment in a bid to either out of loyalty to another group, usually a tribal group, or in the hope of being able to be in a position to use their leverage as a former and as a military power to leverage their own benefits, their own rent status. So that's your fragmentation. In some regions, this fragmentation is so bad it's broken out into Shiran rebellion. In the north, we have the Houthi insurrection. Now, a little word about the Houthi. When we say Shia, right, when you hear the word Shia, the first question you should ask is which ones and what kind? And to answer that question, we play a game I like to call Count the Imams. Right? Sunnis, four cubs, end of story. Shia, four caliphs and one imam, four caliphs and eight imams. Or in the case of Iran, four caliphs and 12 imams. Right? It's a lot of imams, right? There's been a lot of reinterpretation of Islam, right? So you can see how far away they've gotten from some of the original four texts in terms of their interpretive tradition, right? The Houthi are fires, right? They are the four caliphs plus Ali. They are the original Shia, right? They go back way back. In fact, they pray the same way Sunnis do. They just happen to add Ali in. Right? This is very controversial if you're into Islamic theology. Fivers and twelvers have about as much in common as Methodists, right, who are members of the local Chamber of Commerce, and snake-eating Pentecostals. Right? The difference in terms of their theology is that substantial. So when we start talking about Shia this or support for, you know, Shia groups supporting one another, you have to remember how fundamental some of these divisions are within the Shia community in order to really do your diligence on the nature of these underlying relationships. So these are the Houthis, right? The Houthis have had four rebellions and four truces with Sana'a, with the capital, and with the government in Yemen since 2004. Right? Four rebellions, four truces since 2004. Every time they have a rebellion, they take all the resources, military resources that are available, usually air power, to go in and level Sana'a, which is the capital city in their region. And then they go back to fighting the insurgents and, you know, fighting the secessionists in the south or elsewhere. This is a recurring practice, right? This is an area where the writ of the state does not extend. And even if there's a truce, the government's in no position to go in there and enforce its policies, right? It just means they're not fighting this week. They may not fight next month. But after the next Ramadan, yeah, they're going to be out. Why? Because the Houthis feel that they're being pushed out, both culturally and religiously, but also because they feel like they're entitled to basically run things. Everyone wants to run their own piece of dirt, and they really want to run their piece of dirt, right? Well, the Houthis happen to be running the border with Saudi Arabia, so there's a major border security problem for Saudi Arabia here. Interestingly enough, the border security problem is not Sunni on Sunni, it's Shia, with Sunnis on either side. Now, because of that, there's a lot of allegations out there, and you usually see this as sort of the Stratfor level analysis, or I like to call it the undergraduate term paper level analysis, alleging that there is Iranian support for the Houthis. It would not surprise me if there was some Iranian support for the Houthis. I haven't been able to find any source document based on a primary source, based on an interview in a region, based on anything that's unclassified that confirms anything other than money being. Maybe a few Revolutionary Guards broke out. But remember, the theological differences between these groups are so substantial that even if there is support, it's more likely to be symbolic than substantive in the end, especially if you look at where Iran is invested elsewhere in the region. Notably, while we're worried about Al-Qaeda, while we've been worried about Al-Qaeda in the space of the last decade, the major preoccupation for the Yemeni security establishment is, and to some extent continues to be, the Houthi rebellion. These are the wars they fought, this is how people came up with the system, this is where people won the medals. Right? So this is what they know. We fight the last war, they're fighting the last war as well. Finally, we have the secessionists in the South. Again, look, more pink bandanas. Right? Socialist resentment from the Civil War never went away. In fact, it was just institutionalized and pushed into a political party, right? Centered around Aden in the south and the general region that was formerly the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. Starting in 2007, there were protests and government crackdowns. All of that emerged from some former military officers who denied their pensions and were way out of proportion. From 2008 into the present, although somewhat less now, there have been pockets of actual armed resistance where secessionists have taken up guns and shot at the Yemeni security establishment. There's also been, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, a convergence with certain southern tribal groups, as those tribal groups seeking new opportunities or new rents have realigned themselves. Right? They've broken away from the central government and have aligned themselves with the secessionists, not because they're socialists, not because they want anything to do with a renewed People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, because they're worried about what they're going to get right now and how they can get the most out of the situation. Improves their negotiating position. Defection improves their negotiating position. We'll come back to that. It's classic Yemen politics, Yemeni politics. And as I mentioned earlier, these secessionists, the Yemeni Socialist Party, this impulse in Yemen society, these are the folks who are the primary progenitors and instigators of the urban street protests we've seen both during the Arab Spring and that we're seeing now in the wake of the Gulf Coordination Council peace plan. So let's look at the Al-Qaeda side of the ledger, the global insurgency, right? Global terrorism. What does global terrorism mean in Yemen? Well, here's our gallery of roads. Right? As I mentioned earlier, if you see any family members in any of these pictures, we can talk about it after the lecture. First, where does this group emerge from? In 2009, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula emerges from the merger of Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia, which is essentially sending people off to fight jihad in Iraq, and the Yemeni Al-Qaeda affiliate, which was composed of sort of the second or third string of Al-Qaeda operatives who had emigrated back to Yemen and were in prison for a while and then broke out of prison and then got out of the business of trying to get out of the organization. So the merger of these two things is where Al-Qaeda, these two national groups, where this particular regional affiliate or regional syndicate came from. As I mentioned earlier, the leaders of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the majority of the people who have risen to the top are not Saudis, right? They're Yemenis who were in Afghanistan and Pakistan with Al-Qaeda during the space of the last decade. And Buhayshi was bin Laden's personal secretary or driver or both, depending on what year you're looking at. Right, so these are people who bought into the cause in their late teens and early 20s and are now in their mid-30s. Right? They're majors and lieutenant colonels. And they're coming back to set up their own insurgency, to redo it, and to make sure they're not fighting the last war. What do we mean by make sure they're not fighting the last war? A lot of what Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has done over the space of the last 3 years is a reaction to the failure of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and specifically al-Zarqawi's strategy of targeting the Shia. Al-Zarqawi's strategy of alienating the local and intimidating the local population. They've learned the lessons of counterinsurgency just as we have. They know that in order to survive in that milieu, in order to be able to swim in that society, they have to build local relationships. Now, most places, Al-Qaeda hasn't really had to do this. They've showed up with fighters. They've showed up with money. In Afghanistan, it's a different situation because you have a lot of merit and the rest. But here, right, here their main target is not the West. Their main target is not, you know, necessarily a former socialist regime. It's the Yemeni security forces and foreigners, right? Their primary target is local, it's not global, right? And they have had minimal involvement in protesting itself. In fact, these guys don't align with the socialists at all. They take advantage of these protests. They like the fact that there's a lot of internal political instability. But that doesn't mean that they're involved in it or they're fomenting it. It's a different phenomenon. So let's take a look at a few of their attributes, right? In most instances over the last decade, Al-Qaeda has gone out of the Arab world into other parts of the Muslim world and tried to colonize it ideologically, politically, and operationally. Right? They've tried to go into places where there have been local conflicts and get those local conflicts to sign up with their war. Right? They're the vanguard. They're taking these local insurgencies and drawing them into the global jihad. Right? Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula isn't doing that so much. These guys have come back from the global jihad and have done their best to reintegrate themselves into indigenous tribal networks. Right? Still have the global ideology, but they're trying to read that global ideology back into something that's local, that's authentic, right? That's much more legitimate and tangible. Right? They benefit, because of that, they benefit from home field advantage. Right? These aren't Arabs lost in Khost. Right? These aren't Arabs trying to find their way around Shatoy in Chechnya. Right? These are Arabs in Yemen, where they and their families have been for generations. Completely different game in terms of social and political mobilization. As I mentioned earlier, they've learned from Al-Qaeda's failure in Iraq, particularly to focus on Shia, and focus on trying to intimidate tribal structures into doing what you want. Something about the Sunni Arab tribes in Al-Anbar province in Iraq, they were all well and good when Al-Qaeda was fighting the Americans, but as soon as Al-Qaeda in Iraq wanted to start marrying their daughters, that relationship started to break down and broke down very quickly. The Marine Corps recognized it, and General Petraeus recognized it, and we were able to turn that around. Here, they know that that's where the weak point was. They know that that particular strategy failed for them. They lost the PR battle. So, to a certain extent, they're willing to, or have been willing to, accommodate their ideological adversaries, not just tribal leaders, right? But also the socialists. They've written a number of interesting articles about a year or two ago, basically saying, you guys have the right ideas when it comes to social justice. You have the right ideas when it comes to Western oppression. He just forgot about Islam. All you have to do is remember Islam, and we can all get together and take over again. They even did the same thing with the Houthis, right? They put this bizarre article out, I think in 2009 or 2010, where they're trying to justify why it's okay for them as a Salafi jihadi movement to reach out to a Shia. And they say, well, really, they're the same as us. It's just this Ali thing, right? They're trying to engage with these groups. That's broken down over the space of the last 6 to 9 months. But initially, they were willing to accommodate the political adversaries, one, because they needed the political space, and two, because if those adversaries were operating, it made Yemen less stable, and they could take advantage of that instability. Most important, and this is sort of, you know, we hear about Al-Qaeda 1.0 and Al-Qaeda 2.0, if there's got to be an Al-Qaeda 3.0, this is it, right? It is the merger of the global Salafi jihadi ideology, understanding of that ideology that dictates with the practical, functional, granular, on-the-ground realities of running insurgency. Right? This is not Marx and Engels, this is Mao. And as a result of that, I would argue, and I think other people who work in this region would argue, that ultimately they are more robust and more resilient because they are rooted. Their ideology may be global, but they are rooted. And that's going to make them harder to beat. Especially given political, economic, social, and ecological collapse that Yemen currently faces. So, what are their objectives? Well, we can break down their objectives very clearly using the near enemy, far enemy dichotomy. The near enemy. First, they want to exploit the social and the political turmoil in Yemen. Who wouldn't? Second, we want to maintain an operational base for Al-Qaeda and like-minded groups in the Arab core, not just in the Arab core, on the Arabian Peninsula. This is extremely important for them, both theologically and ideologically. Third, they want to co-opt and unify local Sunni Arab tribes, right? They want to bring these forces into their network rather than forcing them to do what they want. They want to co-opt and bring them along, lead them along, right? They've talked about forging an alliance with Al-Shabaab and Somalia. It's a very complicated relationship. First, Yemenis and Somalis have, shall we say, no lack of ethnic chauvinism in that relationship. That's the first point. The second point is Al-Shabaab, even though it's moved sort of up the ladder from being a local insurgency to being a more regional organization, and even though it's radicalized ideologically over time, Al-Shabaab has done these things in a bid not to go global, but in an effort to get global resources pulled into their theater of operations. They're reaching outside their area for internal support rather than going out of area as a strategy. So this, they're resource constrained, right? And they represent a potential drag on the UAP, which is also resource constrained to a certain degree. So this alliance may exist in terms of press releases, in terms of, you know, nice letters sent back and forth. You may see it on, you know, the Hafqaz website or some of these other jihadi websites, but on paper, it's much more contested because both of these groups want the other to do what they want. Why do they want to do all this? Well, ultimately, they want the same thing that Bin Laden wanted, which is to tally the top of the Saudi regime and the install a theocracy in Saudi Arabia and Yemen with the objective of purifying the Arabian Peninsula and eventually restoring the caliphate. That's the end of the story. But let's look at the far end again. Okay, shoot over here. There we go. We all know this job. Their far end strategy, right? Just because they're locally integrated doesn't mean they aren't operating internationally, right? The shift does not mean that they've gone completely local. It means they've blended the global and the local in a way that's more robust and resilient. They still have a global agenda. They still have a global operational profile. The primary goal is to reestablish al-Qaeda propaganda operations. Right? Those operations take a major hit with our drone operations in the federally administrated tribal areas in Pakistan over the last 10 years, and they'd like to bring that back. The second thing is there's been, especially with some of the magazines and the other communiques they've been putting out in space the last 2 years, especially Anwar Al-Awlaki's material, an effort to incite Anglophone, English-speaking Muslims, living in the West to violence, to create the semblance of a global movement, right? And also to give us sort of a sense of perpetual insecurity, so we're ramping up our own efforts. They call it death by a thousand cuts, right? Every time we increase our security in homes, resources we're spending at home rather than gunning at it again. It's a form of attrition, basically, a very indirect and attenuated form, that's the general theory of it. There's been some talk among their circles about provoking a U.S. military intervention in Yemen. Right? This is arguably part of the motive behind the attempted Christmas Day bombing. Right? It was another major airline disaster on Christmas Day of all days, right? That there'd be such a public outcry that the United States would need to put forces into Yemen, and we'd have another Afghanistan situation all over again. Right? Another traditional situation that would mobilize the complacent Muslim masses, bring them to their banner, and then they would co-opt and unify local Sunni Arab tribal structures, topple the Saudi regime and install a theocracy, and purify the Arabian Peninsula and eventually restore the caliphate. Global objectives, local objectives, all come back to this idea of restoring something, restoring an imagined past, restoring an imagined future. So net assessment, politics, society, and war. Where are we now? This is being a little Gucci here. First, in the political situation, political domain, we have essentially a revolution with the Arab Spring, and then we have a counter-revolution that happened with the guise of the revolution. The Gulf Coordination Council Agreement created a transitional government led by Saleh's Vice President Hadi. Right? In November, Hadi called for snap elections pursuant to this agreement to be held this month in February, sparking opposition protests, especially in the last week, the opposition, the Yemeni Socialist Party, and its allies have been very, very active in Aden and elsewhere. Despite this new power-sharing government, right, that has Al's Law and the General Congress Party and some other elements in it, Hadi's the only candidate on the ballot. Does this not sound familiar? It's exactly, this sounds very familiar. So what I'd argue is that in the political domain, if you're looking at the situation in Yemen right now, there's an equilibrium to it, right? The equilibrium is driven by the interplay between state and society. That interplay is dysfunctional. Yemeni politics, like Yemeni society right now, are in a state of dysfunctional equilibrium. And that dysfunctional equilibrium is going to be very, very hard to change as long as you have a structure, right? As long as you have political institutions that are taking this sort of strategy to solve a political problem. How do we solve a political problem? By consolidating the centralized state, which we should be in charge of. Never mind that society is decentralized. Never mind that the sources of legitimacy and authority in society have always been spread out. Never mind the society's undergoing massive demographic, ecological, and economic collapse. So what's happening in the social domain? Well, we have this tension between populism on one hand and tribalism on the other. Urban Yemeni elites, the Yemeni Socialist Party and others, have opted for populist protests. Very, very similar phenomenon to what we've seen elsewhere in the Muslim, elsewhere in the Arab world, in the Arab Spring, and the Islamist summer, and then God of the kind of so this is an urban phenomenon in Yemen, and it's a very credible one that should be taken on its own terms. If you want to read a good book about it, I recommend Robin Wright's Rock the Casbah. That, unlike some of the other books on the Arab Spring, is really based on Floyd in the field and patrol interviews and being there when these things were happening. Now, rural Yemeni elites, i.e. tribal leaders, have taken a different approach. right? These folks aren't educated. They don't have the same kind of base. Doctors and bureaucrats, right? They're different, come from a different part of society. What they're doing is they're reasserting tribal authority. They're saying, core, central government, we are the regional power brokers, and you need to give us more authority, more resources, remember managing the rents, and more of what we want in order to stabilize the situation. And this situation has sort of gone from a race to the bottom kind of dynamic as the sources of the national patronage system have broken down. And it's been accelerated by this first phenomenon, the instability with the urban communities. One of the things that I mentioned earlier is that this reassertion of tribal authority at the local level in rural Yemen is also occurring in line with a realignment of a lot of these tribal authorities. As I mentioned earlier, some of these tribes are pulling out and are aligning themselves with this other secessionist movement. Right? Others have actually chosen to realign themselves with Al-Qaeda, right? Because Al-Qaeda can provide the school. Al-Qaeda can provide the new wealth. Right? Al-Qaeda can provide a new mosque. And Al-Qaeda is not just showing up telling people what to do, it's showing up, you know, developing the system, so in a way that they've never done before. Interesting thing about Islam. Right? We in the West tend to think that all of these things are driven by religion, that religion is the primary driver or the definer of all of these dynamics, that everything can be explained if we just understand Islam or understand what Islam really is. In the case of Yemen, Islam is a legitimizing force, right? I'm doing what I'm doing because it's Islamic. It's holy, it's approved by God, this is Sharia, right? This is justice, this is what the Prophet would wanted, right? It's not necessarily a mobilizing force. The mobilization is happening because of tribal and social, political, and economic factors. Islam is just the reason for justifying it. It's the public relations. And that's something that makes what's happening in Yemeni society different in some very, very important fundamental ways from what AQAP is about ideologically. And that's also something that's important to keep in mind as we move forward in Yemen, because that's an area of potential breakdown and tension between AQAP and society as AQAP tries to expand its roots. So the third, we have politics, we have society, we have war. It's like an Oxford history, you know, history of war somewhere. So counterinsurgency, right? We are used to be in a counterterrorism framework in Yemen. Right? When we have a problem with the militant, we throw them, right? We hit them with a bomb, and we find some other way to have small units that are us and the British go in and help the Yemenis take care of a discrete problem in a discrete place. Well, as Al-Qaeda has expanded its ability to function in the Yemeni society, Yemeni security forces and those of us who are sort of keeping an eye on them, counseling them, are moving to something that's starting to look a whole lot more like a counterinsurgency model, right? And that is because Al-Qaeda is gaining strength, abandoning its past efforts to engage the Shia socialists, we mentioned that earlier. Most importantly, Al-Qaeda is beginning to behave less like a global terrorist syndicate and more like a local insurgency. I mentioned that earlier. But here's the kicker, right? When I was in southern Afghanistan back in 2005, how did we know the Taliban was starting to become a problem again? Because the Taliban started doing things like seizing territory, renaming cities, establishing checkpoints, and trying to govern. AQAP in five provinces in Yemen, some more than others, some districts and provinces much more than others, starting to look like Taliban. They're starting to do this sort of Mao second phase insurgency stuff. They're starting to consolidate a base, not just using the terror and raiding, actually consolidate a base from which they can expand their area of operations, expand their influence, you know, manage rents, gain resources, all the rents. That's why this is starting to move from a counterterrorism into a counterinsurgency type situation. Again, it's not completely there yet, but it is moving in that direction, especially in the last three months. Finally, it's worth noting that as part of this, just like the Taliban in Afghanistan, AQAP is co-opting some tribal factions and challenging others. Right? In one district, they may be allies. The next district over, they may be adversaries. Right? This makes its activity hyper-local. It means that the level of our analysis needs to be equally granular. When we show up in Sana'a, we're talking to the Yemeni security forces, guys who've never been outside the bunker unless they're shooting at somebody. Our guys were not plugged into the local tribal structures, we may be getting only part of the story. I can guarantee you, you're going to be getting a story that's designed to bring in as many external resources as they can possibly use to keep their institutions running. And if you want to be a QAP, you've got to know what districts they have friends in, what districts they have enemies in, and find some way to set those two groups against one another. Right? Because the dysfunction and equilibrium in Yemen is still an equilibrium. Every society is going to try to create its own equilibrium, even under conditions of war. Manage the equilibrium, you manage the problem. Disturb the equilibrium, right? Create a sort of a false incentives in the equilibrium by empowering the wrong social structures. And you can actually make the problem worse. So policy implications. First, intersections with these various global moving problems. Second, general observations about Yemen in particular, but also how we should understand things at the global, in terms of global trends, regional dynamics, and local challenges. And then finally, lessons. Lessons for the warfighter and lessons for the policymaker. So first, intersections. This is a great map. Those of you who haven't seen it. The red is AQAP's operation, generally assumed operational sphere. Right, this area up here, right along the southern border, this is where the Shia Houthi are active. And this whole yellow area, this is the former People's Republic of Yemen, right? That's where the Southern Secessionist Movement is most active. Notice this overlap area right here in the middle. Right? And the places that are the most important to watch right now are Abyan Province and Sabah Province. That's where Al-Qaeda has been the most active militarily, although they've done pretty well in Marib in just the space of the last month as well. They captured the city about 200 kilometers away from Sana'a, two or three hour drive away from Sana'a, and then negotiated with the wall, and it's all very complicated, but watch these three provinces right there. That's where the action is going to be over the next 3 to 6 months. So general observations. First, going back to our macro trends, understanding the global trends. How should we condition our thinking about Yemen and about the Middle East in general? Well, first off, the factors that drive radicalization and contemporary Islamic militancy in these societies tend to be local rather than global. It's from the bottom up. Tip O'Neill's right, all politics is fundamentally local. But the ideological and rhetorical expression of that resistance, right, of this violence, has to be global. There's a global narrative. What we're doing is important because it plugs into what they're doing over there. We saw this also in the Arab Spring, right? When the Egyptians didn't want the Tunisians to suddenly be doing better than them. I mean, I also mentioned that it's happening between civilizations as well. The Russians are hopping mad that the Arabs are having elections. Hopping mad. Right? It's bad enough that the Poles have elections, but now the Arabs are having revolutions. Superficial similarities, and this is sort of the theme of my book, but also something that I think is very, very important for us to be thinking about within our academic work and in our policy work, and also on the ground, whether you are a sort of brigade commander or you are a fire team squad leader. Superficial similarities between militant movements often mask profound political, ideological, and operational differences between them. We learned this the hard way in Iraq. We've tried to apply it to the extent that we know how in Afghanistan. It's just as important. The next point, we need to focus not just on the factors that bring these groups together, right? Islam tends to be the factor that we refer to when we talk about what brings these groups together. We also need to look at the dynamics that drive them. Right? What are their fundamental interests? How do they perceive those interests? What are their capabilities? Are they willing to subordinate their objectives in the short term to some other group in the hope of some long-term gain? In some instances, the answer is yes, but in most instances, especially in Yemen, right, we have this dysfunctional equilibrium where everyone is defecting in order to improve the negotiating position. I would venture to say no, unless the situation is truly, truly desperate. Additional observations discerning regional dynamics. How should we understand what's happening in the Middle East generally right now? Well, first off, our interests lie, I would argue, chiefly in isolating the insurgent groups from the global transnational syndicates that can do us the most harm in the West. This is David Kilcullen's idea of disaggregation, right? The disaggregation at the tactical or operational level needs to be elevated to the strategic and policy level. We don't have a language for doing that yet. We don't have criteria for doing that yet. We know how to do it. When we think about the Middle East, this should be task number one, especially as we're working under resource constraints, especially if we're dealing with you know, forces that have been degraded and eroded over the space of 10 years of continuous warfare. Right? The other thing we need to keep in mind when we want to listen to Iraq is that large-scale military interventions and prolonged campaigns like we've had in Afghanistan can actually create the conditions that foster conversions between these local and global groups, right? If you interfere with the local equilibrium the wrong way, things can go the wrong way. Second thing is we have to be very, very careful about overreacting to al-Qaeda's provocations. Remember that in insurgency warfare, the first phase is provocation. Right? It's using terror and raiding and all sorts of other tools to get your adversary to overstep, do something stupid, and alienate the civilian population. Right? If we overreact in a situation in a place like Yemen, right, if our responses to their provocations are not proportional and targeted and seem to be legitimate, we might actually strengthen their position. It's worth it losing a couple guys if the PR value is so high that they can sign up 3 or 4 or 5 times that number. So watch about creating enemies while trying to fight them. Finally, we have this fundamental problem in Washington. It's more of a political problem than it is an analytical problem. And that's the failure to distinguish between militants on the one hand and the devout on the other. There's a big difference between someone who believes very, very deeply in their religion and someone who's willing to pick up a gun and kill somebody else because of theirs. Right? There's been a lot of research on radicalization. Right? What takes someone who, you know, is normal, right, not militant, makes them militant, what pushes them over the edge? Right? But that, a lot of that research on radicalization focuses on Islam, Islamic, and Islamist ideology. These things may be aligned in some instances, they may be misaligned in other instances, but there's a distinction to be drawn between believers on the one hand and killers on the other. Killers are not necessarily all believers. Right? Let's not forget that Nasser Khan was a petty criminal before he decided to become a terrorist mastermind. Right? His conversion, his dream was not sort of, you know, just a religious experience. It was also a way of legitimizing his behavior. Right? And we also have to remember that not all killers are believers. These things can are distinct categories. So in terms of our own politics, in terms of our own presumptions, in terms of our own assumptions about who our adversary is, we have got to draw this distinction much more clearly. Finally, confronting local challenges in Yemen and in other theaters where we are likely to be involved, whether it's with a heavy footprint, a light footprint, or as I like to call it, the ultra-light footprint, the 72-hour footprint, right? Our success depends, in this whole domain, our success depends on aligning the instruments of national power that we have, right, with the unique challenges posed by each of the different strains of Islamic militancy, right? The challenges of each of the different strains of local insurrection and global insurgency. We have to know who our adversary is, what they want, and where they hope to go, and then align our powers with their economic, political, development, or military accordingly. The second thing, we really have to look about our presumptions and assumptions, right, about global terrorism. Ultimately, these things tell us more about ourselves, about what our values are, and they tell us about our adversary. Writing in the wake of, gosh, the Napoleonic Wars, I think it was, Karl von Clausewitz said that the most important task that the statesman and the commander have to make is to discern what kind of war they are embarking on, not mistaking it for or turning it into something alien to its true nature. Know your enemy, and don't focus so much on yourself. This goes to a core question of percent constant focus on the notion of an existential, a perpetual existential threat. Yemen does not pose a perpetual existential threat to the United States. Even if al-Qaeda takes over Yemen, it's likely to mess things up in the region. We're likely to see a whole lot more out-of-area terrorist operations. We're likely to see the Saudis get very, very agitated. But it's not like these folks are going to come and take over the capital. They don't have that kind of capability. They can seriously affect our interests, but they do not necessarily affect our survival. Distinguishing between interests on the one hand and survival on the other is also going to be very important in terms of figuring out what our priorities are and how to align these groups of national power. And finally, you know, ultimately our focus on ends over means tends to reflect, in my opinion anyway, as a lawyer speaking, a profound cynicism about the basis of our own constitutional law. Right? Nietzsche wrote a lot of things, and a lot of them are very controversial, but one of the things that he wrote that I think is very insightful, especially for military audiences, is, you know, be careful when you're fighting dragons, lest you become one. Understand that you're fighting to protect a system of values that you believe in, not necessarily destroy somebody else's system of values. And it's a protective measure, not an offensive measure. And again, as long as we're focused on ends rather than means, you know, democracy, the means are the ends. It's the way we mediate, you know, whether violence is legitimate, whether force is legitimate, whether regulation and all of these other things we think about are legitimate, whether they're sustainable. In Yemen, they don't have any regulation of the means. And look at the situation we've got ourselves into. Our society survives and prospers because we think about the means and because we don't separate the means from the means. Some major lessons for commanders, for military officers, and others. Local conditions matter more than regional trends. Different events have different causes. Amazing. Coincidence is neither correlation or causation. Just because two bad things go down at the same time in the same place does not mean the same people do them. Right? Ultimately focusing exclusively on global terrorism, the rubrics we've created around global terrorism, gives us limited insights into the very, very local, granular dynamics that we need to effectively fight these small wars. For statesmen and stateswomen, right? Local instability fosters regional insecurity. No surprises there. Right? Diplomacy, and here this is a surprise, diplomacy needs to engage societies, not just states. But if you look at where the money is going in Yemen, right? If you look at where we're sending our democracy support money, where we're supporting our developmental aid, who our diplomats and others are talking to get there, it's these urban, educated elites or these people within the national security structures. Nobody's sitting down with the local tribal leads. That level of social engagement is simply not happening. Now, part of that is because Yemen is, oh my God, dangerous. But part of it is also because of the way we see the state-to-state relationships, right? In the case of Yemen, state-to-state doesn't matter so much. It's gotta be state-to-society. Because society is where legitimacy and power and authority come from. AQAP is opportunistic, but it's not yet dominant. It will take advantage of any opportunity it has to consolidate and expand its zone of operations. But it's not dominant. Right? It's unlikely to become dominant because the dysfunctional equilibrium in Yemen means eventually someone's going to decide that Al-Qaeda presents a threat to their local interests as well. And that's where the opportunity lies for not just commanders who may need to go on the ground and advise any officials, but also for statesmen who are trying to think about the best way to manage these problems and tight resources. And finally, getting to our values, getting also to our strategy and the relationship between strategy and values, focusing exclusively on our near-term security risks, especially in a theater like Yemen, undermines our long-term interests, undermines our ability to influence the chain of events in a manner that's going to be more stabilizing, it's going to expand the zone of security, prosperity, and freedom in a way that allows us to manage the international system in the way that we want to manage it. Right? We're always thinking short term. We always think the urgent comes to be important, and the important will never be attended to. This is true in the political and military domain as it is in personal lives. So finally, in conclusion, why do I call this speech, why am I saying drawing the dagger? Because depending on the level of analysis you're using, depending on the granularity of that analysis, depending on who's the one actually pulling the dagger out, that act can have a number of different meanings. Right? Now let's not understate the importance of the jambiya, this particular kind of dagger, in Yemeni society. Right? It has a functional element. This is basically everyday carry Yemeni kit, right? Yemeni fashion. The hilt tells you how much money you have. Right, what your social status is, or even what region you come from. Right? Men know who other men are in the social order by looking at their dagger. The hilts tend to be very ornate. There's a lot of symbolism built into what goes into the hilt. Right? You can see that example right here. But the blades are extremely functional, they're very practical. Right? Nothing fancy about that thing. Also, look at the nature of the weapon itself. You know, when I was running around in the Caucasus, they have a weapon called a kinjal. About the same length, but it's narrow and it's straight. It's like a Roman gladius, it's a thrusting weapon. You get hit with that thing and one for a vital organ. You can get in, you can get out, you can get going. This is a slashing weapon. It's about intimidation. The only way you can really do somebody in with one of those is get them in a headlock. Right? So this is much more symbolic weapon than it is sort of a practical fighting blade. Let's keep that in mind, because the symbolism surrounding the Jumbi and Yemeni society varies. In some instances, as I mentioned earlier, it's mostly about cultural tradition. This is how we know who we are, where we came from, and how we're connected to others. Sometimes people draw the dagger because they're celebrating some ritual. It might be an Islamic holiday. Most often, it's drawn during weddings, and men will dance around waving the daggers with each other. Women, of course, are my ancestors. The dagger can also be drawn for another reason, and that's an act of desperation. The dagger is not to be drawn. Jumbi is not to be drawn, except for as an act of last resort, when the personal safety of the bearer is threatened, and the safety of his family. So if someone's dragging the dagger because it's cultural, we need to understand that, right? If someone's drawing the dagger because they're having a party, right, because they're protesting something, they want to show, here's my man, they're gonna, we have to understand that. And most importantly, we need to distinguish the tradition and the celebration from the desperation. Because if we don't draw those distinctions, if we don't figure out what kind of war we are embarking on, as Klaus would say, then it's likely that we're going to see a whole lot more of the desperation and a whole lot less of the tradition. Thank you.
I think Dr. Swift has left us with a lot of thoughts, not only on Yemen, but much broader. You see Cambridge here coming out. Thank you. The floor is open to questions and answers. We have about 15 minutes. Please identify yourselves and ask your questions. Sir, please.
So I'm an analyst with the Drug Warfare Analysis Center. And there's a couple of my three thoughts I heard that I'm going to ask you about. One is Yemen or other places are not existential. How do we apply the resources to get down and collect the information we need at the local level? I mean, the United States, as you said, is very short-term. How do we make sure we do the proper intelligence collection methodologies in these local areas to try and educate the state and the military? It's not existential.
I have an anecdote and I have a statistic. First, there's an anecdote that somebody told me when I was running around the Middle East, and it was about a city in Morocco that no one could ever conquer. The English tried to conquer it, the French tried to conquer it, the Germans even tried to conquer it, and they could never get, an army into that city. It was impenetrable. So eventually, a Frenchman decided that he would conquer it by learning the language, taking on the culture, taking on life, and becoming a man of prominence who was then invited into the city. That's the kind of relationship and engagement that we need to have, not something that's going to be the next 2 weeks. Right? So that's the anecdote. Here's the statistic that I found absolutely frightening. I saw an article, I think it was in the Washington Post, maybe it was 20. I'm not quite sure where I saw it, but I saw it about a month or two ago that said that 18% of current employees of the Central Intelligence Agency speak a language other than English. Let me say that again. 18, and this is somebody else's statistic, not 18% of people currently employed by the Central Intelligence Agency speak a language other than English. How many of them do you think speak a language other than English and maybe Spanish? Or English and maybe French? How many of you think speak Urdu? Pashto? Persian? There aren't that many Russian speakers over there anymore. How many of them speak Arabic? But if you look at the aggregate number of people that are now taking these languages since we started a decade ago, it's substantially better. But if you look at the percentage of our force in intel, in the military, that have these languages at a level of proficiency that allows them to deploy it, right? Allows them to sit jirga in Afghanistan without an interpreter. We don't have that. Maybe 50 guys, maybe 15 girls. Right? If you want to understand these societies, you want to be able to collect intelligence, open source and closed source, at a level of granularity, you've got to go British. You have to master these languages at the undergraduate level. You have to encourage language training throughout people's career. I don't mean like trained up to become a foreign area officer. I mean, continual sustainment of the language capability. And you've got to do deep cultural immersion. There's no way around it. Right? When I was in Central Asia this summer, I went from the Afghan-Tajikistan border, 1,400 kilometers, up through the Fergana Valley, to some of the garden spots in northern Tajikistan, southern Kyrgyzstan. Talked to a whole bunch of guys from Hizbullah Tahrir, a whole bunch of former IMU operatives. Then went up and spoke to the intel people in Bishkek and elsewhere. There, the Kyrgyz intel people. None of these guys, like, I'm able to function in Russian, but if I had the local language, if I had Uzbek, or if I had Tajik, the level of those conversations would be so much richer. Right? And the number of people who are actually going out and doing this sort of thing is also very, very small. So if you want to improve our intelligence collection, if you want to improve the way we understand and interact with these places, you have got to train people and value the things and capabilities that allow people to do that. Not just for one tour, not just for a couple of years, not just for a billet, but throughout an entire career. I'm sorry that's not a short-term answer, and it's probably not an answer that Congress is likely to hear and understand. But that's the answer. Right? If you want to manage these areas, you have to manage them from the bottom line.
Can you give us insight into the Yemeni military? What are they, urban elites? What's their literacy rate? Are they tribal affiliated?
It depends on what part of the Yemeni military you're talking about. If you're looking at the military command structure, the high command, a lot of those are people who are related through marriage or through tribal connections to the current president, or sorry, the recently retired president. If you're looking at people who are sort of the colonels, you know, lieutenant colonels and people down from there, you're looking, you know, sort of your lower the staff level personnel. Those folks tend to be people who are from prominent local tribes that are aligned with the government. And as you work your way down the chain of command, right, into the enlisted corps, then you start to realize that, you know, you're getting out of those elites. The elites there are this interesting mixture of the urban elite and the tribal elite, predominantly tribal, because positions in the military, positions in the security establishment are one of the ways that Saleh's regime distributed the rents. And it's one of the ways they manage the patronage. So by having that, you know, by drawing those particular individuals in, they were able to strengthen these particular tribal relationships with the Senate. But don't forget that the person who's running the Yemeni security services, correct me if I'm wrong, the brother of, or the brother-in-law of the former president. So these relationships, as in other places in the region, are not just structural, they're not just tribal, they're also intensely personal, on personal and family level in some sense.
Yes, please.
Sir, Chris Harmon with the University faculty. This would ask you to put one foot outside the Yemeni area to answer, but do you have a sense for the effectiveness and influence of Inspire magazine on its English language readers? Do you have any metrics? And would you expect it to be reestablished now in Yemen or not?
Let me answer the second question first. I think they will reestablish it when they have somebody who's clever enough to manage the language. Right? Getting back to the question of language, the way they were able to create that magazine and infiltrate our society was having somebody who knew our society from the inside out. And so they had the gift of language and knew how to communicate in our language on our terms. And we've got to be able to do that in the post. As for metrics on how well is, until you have someone who's at that level, I think it's unlikely that they're going to be able to deploy something that's going to matter very much in the information operations domain. In terms of metrics, you know, I'm really the wrong guy to ask about that because my research focuses on the legal dimensions of all of this, on the relationship between Al-Qaeda and indigenous groups. I don't do sort of the resonant effect of lone wolf stuff the way somebody like Peter Norman at King's College London would. So if you're looking for those sort of statistics, I would point you towards the International Center for Radicalization and whatever it is at King's College London. They're probably most likely to have done that kind of a study, primarily because they're interested in looking at how a magazine like that influences the English-speaking Muslim population in Great Britain. I think it's clear to say that, I mean, one thing that's true is that this sort of, some people call it lone wolf jihadism, I call it resonant effects because we have an individual who's resonating with the jihad, even though they may not be from there, they may not know the culture, they may not even have Arabic, right? and it's very, sometimes these relationships are very attenuated. A lot of that's being done through the internet. A lot of it is so highly attenuated and decentralized, it's really hard to manage, which is why this distinction between the militant and the devout is so important in terms of domestic intelligence gathering. But if we can't engage Muslim communities in the United States, including communities that are very, very conservative, right, but who may not be militant, we're not able to draw that distinction in our efforts to engage those communities. We see them all as being potential adversaries. If our default setting is this potential fifth columnist, then we're not going to be able to understand, much less appreciate, how this kind of radicalization, attenuated radicalization's resonant effects really manifest in certain places. I'm sorry, that's the best answer I can give to that question. No legal questions?
Yes, please.
How good is Al-Qaeda governing, given the dire social and economic conditions you just described?
That's another very hyper-local question. And we do not have good metrics for that. What I will say is they learned, these guys who were sort of the junior level operatives on your Al-Qaeda senior leadership in Afghanistan saw what the Taliban were doing and saw, learned from them. They're not just reading Abu Bakr Nashi, right, and sort of, three-phase global approach to managing what regions, the jihad wanted to take over first. They've actually seen this in them. They're very practical guys. They're much less theoretical and ideological than the older generation. But in terms of how well the governing, well, look, if you can build a school, right, where the government wasn't able to build a school, if you can drill in well, right, where the government was not willing to drill in well, it may not matter how well you're governing if you're providing the services that people desperately need. Remember, if people are acting on the basis of an act of desperation because of the social and economic and ecological collapse all around them, people start to do funny things when their kids are hungry. Just put it that way. If that's the situation that you're dealing with, how good they are at government may not matter if they've got a quid pro quo kind of relationship. But the best way to answer that question is to put people out in the field. We don't have anybody on the field who's answering that question right now.
Any last questions? Kristen, please.
Since you talked about the government being a local, the typical way that I feel like Marines have gone into Afghanistan was to try to help the local population see an advantage in Jarawa. But I think the core society was very much like what you're describing, Yemen. It's a decentralized state that's been fighting again to centralize itself. It seems like your message is go find out what they want. We know that they want schools and water and health care. But it didn't really work in Afghanistan because we were always fighting that decentralized instinct.
Well, remember what we're trying to do in Afghanistan. We try to do three things simultaneously. We try to build a state, right, a modern nation state, which, with the exception of a brief 30-year period, including your early childhood, didn't really exist in Afghanistan during the course of history. They had a kingly state, and they had kingdoms that had all kinds of other religions. They didn't have a modern nation state in sort of the secular Western sense. So we tried to build a state. Then we tried to fight a massive insurgency with deep roots. And at the same time, we try to engage the population, population-centric operations. Right? Centralizing the state, engaging a decentralized population, and more at the same time. Which one of those two, three things should we put first? My point is, each one of these is a gargantuan undertaking.
Exactly.
Right? Each one of these is potentially a multi-generational undertaking. If you're talking about the non-military aspect, right? We try to do them all at the same time. So we shouldn't be surprised if it fails. In terms of identifying what they want, right? I'm not talking about sort of global social welfare, right? For places that are subject to insurgency. We've seen that in Asia building, state building, humanitarian intervention, whatever you want to call it. We have a whole bunch of different words that we use to describe and legitimize that kind of intervention. What people in these regions want, generally speaking, is legitimacy, authority, and control over the daily affairs. That's why they fight. They want to be able to make choices about their own lives and about their children's lives. Now, we may not like those choices. We may fundamentally disagree with some of the decisions they make, right? But they see themselves as trying. People don't fight just against threats. They also fight for a better life, right? So simply providing services isn't necessarily the metric. It's much more nuanced than that. It's much more personal than that. You know, Sheikh A in District A may want a certain set of deliverables. And we may be able to show up with generators and, you know, like backhoe drill new well or something like that. But Sheikh B in a different district may be concerned about his social state. Right? He may be concerned about multiple people vying for, vying for his particular position. He may be concerned that Al-Qaeda is going to come in and try to marry his daughters. And this is the problem he had over and over again in the hospital. Right? So these things are very, very manual. You can't just take a sort of Western development social welfare kind of model, drop it into these places, call it counterinsurgency. Right? That lending really is going to be from the bottom up rather than top down. And it is a gargantuan undertaking. Again, more questions, imperfect answers, but change your perspective on it. The things that we've built well in this country have not been built from the top down. It was built from the bottom up with support from the top. Right? When we've gone in and we've done aid and yet we've gone in and we've given support from the top, right? Take care of this problem, and here's some money for your security establishment. Take care of this problem, here's some money for your security establishment. The French will give you money for crops, the Germans will give you money for water, the British will give you the SAS to train up your guys, the United States will give you the kit. It doesn't trickle down, right? It's got to be at both levels at the same time. I don't know how to manage that. I can't tell you how to manage that. It's an extremely, extremely difficult proposition. What I can tell you is that if you presume that it can be managed from the top down with this kind of dysfunctional equilibrium, your presumption isn't going to get much further than the CEO.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.